What do we want? To change the status quo. Fight the power of politically charged colours, data and designs. Challenge what we're told and why we are expected to believe it. Uncover the true meaning of the map. This is Radical Cartography. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. In this podcast, we hear from those who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. Radical cartography shows a geography that's messier and lumpier, with more overlaps and internal diversity, burdened by the weight of history. This is the rallying call of our guest today, who wants us to reimagine what a map can be and how it can be used. William, or Bill, Rankin is a historian of science at Yale University, where he specialises in the history of mapping and the geographic sciences. What gives him a unique insight into the history of maps is that he trained as an architect, and he is a celebrated cartographer in his own right. And he's included this fascinating career blend into his new book, Radical Cartography: What Maps Tell Us About Who We Are. It's a beautiful book full of, well, you've guessed it, maps, some of which Bill's created himself. Bill, it's a real honour to have you with us here today. You're currently in Connecticut and I'm in London. How's it going over there?
It's all right. We've got a lot of snow here, but I'm staying cozy.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's go straight in because we have a lot to talk about your book and your work. And let's start with, you're going to talk to us about actually two maps, but what's the first map that you're going to talk to us about today, Bill?
Yeah. So the first map that I brought in is, it's a powerful kick in the face kind of map. It first appeared in 1971 in a kind of typewritten journal. It's mimeographed. It's got a kind of purple tinge to the paper. It shows a neighborhood on the east side of Detroit. The title is a total slap in the face.
Yeah.
Where commuters run over black children on the Point downtown track. So the map shows the street grid of this neighborhood in eastern Detroit. And at a lot of the intersections, there's these little circles.
Mm.
And the circles each symbolize a place where there was an accident between a car and a pedestrian. So the pattern of the map shows these sort of strings of circles clustering mostly on the east-west streets, the ones that the white commuters would use to go from the suburbs to the east,
and are these
to downtown.
Are these arrows, the arrows that you've got on this map as well, Bill, what are the arrows showing us?
Yeah, so the arrows here are showing one-way streets.
Right.
So the streets that have the most accidents are one-way streets that are mostly one-way going toward downtown. So the data pattern on the map shows this east-west pattern of child pedestrian accidents in Detroit. And then the larger sort of story of the map, you know, what's beyond the map, is this sort of larger pattern of American urbanism in the late 1960s, 1970s, of white flight, rich white commuters moving to the suburbs, commuting through this neighborhood to get to downtown. And there's a highway just off the border of the map that's not shown on the map, but it was usually clogged with traffic. And so what we have here are these people who would then cut through this neighborhood to try to avoid that traffic and with shocking regularity would hit and sometimes kill the children in the streets.
Because, I mean, it's a very prosaic looking map in some ways, Bill, but also the content is kind of tragic urban loss. And also it's a map clearly about race and urbanism as well.
Yeah, it's not a flashy design. It's one color. It's basically a black and white map. It's got plenty of data. It's got hundreds of these dots, but it's not a whiz bang kind of visualization. It's not multivariate. It's not trying to show everything at once. It's not a big glamorous wall map. It's a small, pretty simple design, pretty modest publication.
But for you, this is very important. It's in the beginning of your book, Radical Cartography. Why have you chosen this? I mean, it's clearly very symbolic for you about a certain argument. So tell me more about it in terms of who made it and what the context for this map is and why it's so important for your work, Bill.
So this map is usually attributed to a guy named Bill Bungie, mm-hmm. Sometimes known as Wild Bill Bungie. His reputation has had ups and downs, but, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, reputation has been kind of resuscitated, be seen as kind of the first radical geographer of a certain sort, definitely one to put aside the priorities of the academy and to try to focus on a new way of doing research that was much more in touch with the needs of community members, much more anti-racist, much more political than what you get in academic research at the time. The thing that I think is really crucial here is that the map was actually a collaboration between Bungie and a woman named Gwendolyn Warren, mm-hmm. Who was his main community collaborator in a lot of the mapping he did in Detroit. And digging into it more myself, talking to Gwendolyn Warren herself, it really seems clear that this is just not his map at all, that this was her map, that she was the one who found the data. She was the one who worked with other friends of hers. And she was the one who grew up on the east side of Detroit and knew about these accidents and knew about the pattern. And it was actually, she made the map, she told me, because the white academics that she was collaborating with didn't believe that this was happening. And she felt like she had to make this map in order to prove to them this kind of basic truth about her life.
There's a lot going on here then. So just unpack some of this for me. So Gwendolyn's working with Bill Bungie. There's a kind of activist dimension here, and also we're getting urban planning colliding with presumably your original training, architecture, and also mapping in this moment, I guess, in the 60s, a sort of radical activism coming together with all these different sort of graphic representations that leads you to this map.
That's right. And so I think that there's a lot going on at the time. There is this, in fact, very big shift away from a certain kind of arm's length academic regard for this more community engaged stuff that Bungie and Warren were both really animated by. And then I think that there's this long shadow of this, where this map has been kind of held up as the best example of what a radical cartography could be. Bungie has been celebrated himself. It's not that no one has noticed Gwendolyn Warren. Certainly people have known her collaboration. But I think that there's a kind of reckoning with the history of the field that's kind of here in this map as well. This idea that, we need to look back and kind of reevaluate some of the heroes of cartography, to take a closer look at people like Gwendolyn Warren, who were actually quite crucial to what was going on, but for decades were erased. And I would say, going to why this is important to me, I think that's a lot of it as well. When I was first making maps, I was making maps that were more animated by design, were more animated by my training as an architect. And I felt a kind of hunger for something that was not just like better design, but that actually was more impact, right? That was actually mapping things that mattered a bit more, that was trying to actually, change the conversation, not just make things more beautiful. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine said, oh, you should look at Bill Bungie. And this is where I found that map. And it actually really did, change the direction of my interests. I found it really fascinating and troubling in ways that were both also inspiring. And my own kind of reckoning with this map was that I went back to all the other stuff that Bill Bungie had done, and it just wasn't as good as this. I didn't like it as much. It didn't speak to me as much. And it was that kind of confrontation with Bill Bungie as a kind of hero in radical geography and cartography that then led me to start asking some of these questions about, why was this map different? What was Gwendolyn Warren's role here? And it really then led to one of the big kind of arguments of the book and one of the things that I try to do in my own maps, realizing that the thing that separates this map from a lot of the stuff that Bill Bungie did himself isn't actually so much the design or the symbols or the text even, but really that personal relationship that Warren had with this neighborhood, that this was, she was making maps of things that she knew and wanted to then bring to the world, rather than the kind of arm's length mapping that's much more common.
Tell me more about Gwendolyn Warren. What's she about? What happens to her?
Yeah, so she, at the time, so in the late 1960s, she was young. She was a teenager, 17, 18 years old. She had recently dropped out of high school after leading about 4,000 students to boycott the public school systems for its segregation and racism. So she was, you know, by nature, an activist, an organizer. She absolutely wanted to change the way that race and segregation were on the ground in Detroit. And she and Bill Bungie and a few others started this organization called the Detroit Geographic Expedition and Institute that was a combination of these kinds of, you know, kind of research reports on things like school desegregation. And they also taught free classes, a bunch of mostly white academics basically allowed to, you know, said that they would offer free classes to anyone in the neighborhood, and the state of Michigan agreed that they would accept those free classes for university credit for people who needed to go to college. So there was this sort of like larger organization that was very much trying to change the way that research was done, the way that education was done. And Gwendolyn Warren was very much part of that, as a very much kind of part of the community and coming from a kind of activist impulse herself. Now, pretty soon after this map was published, or even before it was published, the organization, the Detroit Geographic Expedition Institute, kind of fell apart. Bill Bungie himself moved or fled, as he would put it, to Canada. He was on a list of you know, radical speakers that had been compiled by the U.S. House of Representatives. His, you know, his family and marriage broke up, and so the institute kind of dissolved. The state of Michigan decided to no longer accept those classes for credit, and so it was a kind of, you know, short-lived experiment. Had a few things come out of it, but it wasn't like a long-standing thing. And Gwendolyn Warren herself, she then went on to a successful career, but a career had nothing to do really with cartography or geography. She worked in municipal government organizations, agencies in California and Georgia and Florida. So she had her own career in some sense, you know, well-launched and quite successful. And talking to her, I got the sense that she was a bit burned by this and went on to do other things. And I think was pleased that in the last 10 years or so, people have started to, you know, appreciate more her role here and have tried to reach out to her for her perspective.
So, Bill, I'm curious at what happens when you actually meet Gwendolyn, because this must be quite a poignant moment, because she was, in effect, to some extent, written out of this map. And your work is really trying to tell a different story and put her back into that narrative. Tell me about that.
She told me about Detroit. She told me about her childhood. She told me about how the map came to be in terms of where the data had come from and who drafted it and that kind of stuff. Yeah, and I think that she really felt that, you know, that there was a story here that she was really trying to tell at the time, that people were a bit reluctant to hear, and that she felt it was kind of similar today, that the stories that she was trying to tell about her own life, about the life of people she grew up with, were still stories that people didn't really want to hear. That they were more comfortable talking about statistics of graduation rates or, you know, school funding or things like that. There was a real reluctance to say, okay, what is it like to live in a place like this? What happens to people in such a fragmented and, you know, starkly unequal society?
And there is a radicalism to that. I mean, this brings us to the argument of the book more broadly. You have a great line at one point where you say, cartography becomes radical when it embraces the inherent uncertainty, multiplicity, and subjectivity of both our data and the world itself. So tell me more about this concept of radical cartography and this inherent uncertainty of geographical data.
Yeah, that's the key sentence. I'm really glad that you found that. That's great. Where I really say, yeah, the three kind of key words, I really think of those values, the values that should animate cartography of uncertainty, multiplicity, subjectivity. So subjectivity, I think you see that very clearly with Gwendolyn Warren's map. This is a map that's coming from her own experience, that's giving shape to that experience of hers. And there's other examples, both mine and from others, of different ways a map can show subjectivity. Either directly, you can show people's lives as individuals, or there's something more like, this is a map that wouldn't be made unless it was being made by somebody who had an understanding of this place. And the uncertainty, I think that there's a way in which a lot of data mapping especially doesn't really stop to ask, you know, does this data deserve to be shown as perfect, super hyper-precise data that we can trust unequivocally? And there's lots of ways to show uncertainty, and statisticians themselves care a lot about uncertainty, I think in a way that's very good and healthy. But I think that there's something about the role of the cartographer as one who ought to kind of make a statement about the data rather than just to show the data. And I think that's a different attitude towards the data than I think what you get in a lot of data visualization, where the idea is the data is given to me and I'm going to show the patterns that I find in the data, rather than I'm going to get this data and I'm going to say, how far can we trust this, and what can I do with this, and how can I kind of, yeah, shine some light not just onto what the data shows, but on what the data might not be showing us. And so I think there's that attitude about the relationship between visualization and data that the uncertainty is really important for.
Before we hear what Bill learned from radical cartographers like Gwendolyn Warren to shape his own mapmaking, I'd love for you to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From mapping the Indigenous Australian Dreamtime to journeying to the North Pole, we have a wealth of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest, or story from this series, or the next. Now, to pore over Bill's map, inspired by his commitment to radical cartography. Because we like your book so much, we've made an exception to you, Bill, and we've allowed you a second map. So tell us, which is connected to the story that we've just heard. So tell us about your second map, and can you just describe it for us?
So the story here is that 10, maybe now 15 years ago, I got an email from a teacher in the suburbs of Chicago, a middle school teacher, who was about to teach a book about a certain set of housing, public housing projects in Chicago, some of the most notorious housing projects in Chicago, which is famous for having, you know, terrible segregation and, dilapidated housing and places where the police wouldn't even go, things like that. And the teacher was going to be teaching this book to his students who lived in the suburbs, who had really no experience with the world being described by this book, and wanted to have an exercise for the students to understand other childhoods that were, you know, other kids who were their age, 10, 11, 12 years old, but just grew up in a totally, totally different environment, really only a few miles from where they were growing up. Mm. And so he had asked them to make a series of maps about the city. He provided the templates, he provided the data, and they basically, you know, used crayons to color these maps in. And for a lot of the data, a lot of the maps, it worked fine. The city was divided into a bunch of kind of chunky neighborhoods, and they would shade in the neighborhoods with crayons for the statistics. But there's a map of race that really didn't work very well. Mm. They would try to shade it in with the crayons. They'd use, you know, hatch patterns and dots and different colors. And it was just a mess. It really wasn't working very well. And so he sent it to me and said, you know, what can you do here? Can you help me with this? And what he didn't know, actually, was that I had grown up outside of Chicago as well. I had read the same book when I was growing up. And I had a similar experience of the book, that this was a hard book to get my head around as a young person. Mm. And so the map of Chicago that I made is a result of that conversation. And the big move here was to say, oh, these showing the city as a series of neighborhoods of solid colored shapes with sharp edges does not work. Mm. It's not a way to show the city. It's not a way to show segregation. So the map that I came up with instead uses, you know, hundreds of thousands of small dots instead of shading these larger areas. But the result is a map of segregation that I think really shows segregation in a much more powerful way. After I made it for this one classroom, it's kind of taken on something of life in Chicago. It's been used now by the public school system itself. So the story here is really, how do we make maps that kind of are true to our understanding of the city? Mm. We understand the city as a starkly segregated place. And the maps we were making weren't really getting that. And so how do we make different kinds of maps to try to show the city differently?
Bill, what does each dot on the map represent?
Yeah, so each dot here represents 25 people. So this is not a, you know, every dot is an individual. Every dot is 25 people. And that is a standard way of making these dot density maps. What I think really is different about this map is that the number of people per dot is much, much less than you get in, say, a textbook dot density map.
And where did you get the data for the map?
The data is from the U.S. Census. One of the, I think, the great virtues of U.S. copyright policy is that all government data is free and available.
And I love the title. Tell me about that and its meaning.
Yeah, so the title here is A Taxonomy of Transitions. And what that is about is really trying to understand how there's lots of different ways of moving from one neighborhood to another. So the standard map of solid colored shapes, there's only one kind of transition. There's a solid line where there's an abrupt transition. And what we see on my map and what we experience in the world is that there's lots of ways to move from one place to a place that feels different. It can be a smooth transition. It can be an abrupt transition. There can be a gap in between. It can be a high density shift. It can be a low density shift. And I think trying to understand that sense that there's many different kinds of spatial transitions in a city like Chicago is a lot of what I'm trying to show here.
Is that multiplicity and big data part of the story as well, that we have shifted so profoundly our understanding of both how you create a map, what a map is, and how you use a map?
I think that it's actually wonderful that we've gone to a world where there's so many more people that can make maps. There's so many more maps available. It's no longer the case that the only maps you could ever get are made by huge institutions or governments, right? Mm. We're not in a world where the only maps you can get are made by National Geographic or Rand McNally or, the CIA. Mm. And that's good. I'm very much in favor of that. And I think that what that means, though, is that we ought to be, both as map makers or map readers, to expect that we're going to be looking for different kinds of maps. We want to compare different maps to each other. We want to not just say, oh, now it's easy to make maps, every map now is unimpeachably reliable and trustworthy. We can kind of break down that naive attitude towards the trustworthiness and reliability of maps, and we can start to ask, who made this and where's the data coming from, and pick at the edges a bit more.
Some people might, though, say, look, we have the Earth. The Earth is a sphere. We can map it in certain ways. And you have this wonderful section on projections, which I just would like you to talk a little bit about because of the way in which you say, no, that's not how it works. And I think it's a great argument in the book that you talk about. A new world map will never be groundbreaking because of its accuracy, objectivity, or errometrics. Instead, it will succeed because it offers a persuasive argument about the global relationships that matter. And that's very, very fascinating because we know that you can't project a globe onto a flat piece of paper. So what is then going on? And for you, there's a certain radical cartography about what comes from that. Just tell me a little bit about that.
You're right. Cartographers, but I think not just cartographers, know that you cannot project the spherical Earth onto a flat piece of paper or screen in a way that doesn't introduce some sort of distortion. Of course, mathematically, we know that's true. And yet there's still so much interest in, well, what's the right answer? What's the one map I should use? Mm. And I get this question a lot. I get this question from colleagues who are making maps for their scholarship. I get this question from everyday friends and, which map should I hang on my kid's wall? And there's an idea that there should still be a right answer. There should be one map that we can get. And the sort of the sensibility in the excerpt you just read is that no, we're not in a world where we should find the one map. We're in a world where we should find a way to be more flexible about having multiple maps. And that there are certainly some maps that are worse and better for certain things. There's some maps that are terrible. There's some maps that are great. But the search for the one map, the search for the one answer, I think is really wrongheaded. And I think that we don't need to live in that world anymore now that we can actually make so many maps much easier.
But there is a politics to that, isn't there, Bill? I mean, I hear that and I agree with that. But I guess one thing that's always worried me is that once you've had the eclipse of those national mapping agencies, so like the Ordnance Survey here in the UK, is now no longer leading on geospatial data. And what are those standard world maps? Is it, are we just in a postmodern space where we say we don't have that anymore, so that's good? But isn't that also ceding things to sort of multinational corporations who can just then define those maps as they wish? You know, there's surely a politics to that, and there's a point where you want to say, well, there's only so far you might want to go with that, or let's be really careful about how we are sleepwalking into certain ways in which those global mapping techniques are no longer maybe about, you know, universal legal or national boundaries, but are actually being driven by very different imperatives.
I think I would disagree. I'm not sure that that's totally a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, Rand McNally, the Times Atlas, the National Geographic, you know, there's the idea that, you know, the standard maps that appear in classrooms and in houses and roadmaps and stuff like that are made by companies that have agendas that might not be ours. That is, I mean, that is that's a story that's at least 150 years old.
Sure.
But I think you're still right. Like, yes, we should absolutely be on guard for that. We should not expect that the goals of either governments or large corporations are necessarily our goals or the only goals that we should consider. And so I think that it's not so much that we're in a new era of great corporate power. I think that we are in a place where we have an opportunity, as much as map readers, as map makers, to see those agendas a bit more. To see that the Googles and the Apples are not just, you know, benevolently mapping the world, but we can ask. And my book is, I'd say, a symptom of this, not just the only one doing it. There's lots of other people doing this as well, saying, "Okay, well, what's going on with these maps, and what kinds of things are they saying about the world that we may or may not want to accept?" And we're now at a position where the other alternative maps are well within our grasp, either to imagine or to make directly. So yes, I think absolutely there is a politics there, a politics of minority voices and minority viewpoints against national or large corporate interests. But I don't think this is necessarily the idea that the most of the maps we encounter are made by other organizations that we might not agree with. I think this is not a new thing.
I'm really intrigued by your background, Bill, because you train as an architect, you're now working mapping, you're also really a historian. And that is such a, in many ways, a familiar story for people who work in the history of maps. People rarely come from the field of geography, which is what you might assume that people work on maps. I myself don't either. And I'm fascinated by that in terms of particularly the importance of architecture for you, because, you know, really, I guess architects, like map makers, are dealing with space in some way. Tell me how you got there and that connection with architecture. I'm really curious.
Yeah, so I was trained as an architect in my undergraduate, and then I worked as an architect for a little bit after college. And it was pretty clear within a couple of years of working that this was not where I wanted to have my career. And actually, that's when I first started making maps, was when I was working as an architect, a bit frustrated by the profession. And making maps was a way of, I didn't really know it at the time, but I think it was a way of engaging some of those same things that fascinated me about architecture, without having to worry about the details of how the buildings would stand up or who would pay for them and things like that. I think that the main thing that I see connecting them for me is that drawing in architecture, you are conjuring something that doesn't exist. You're bringing it into being, and the way you draw it matters hugely. Architects care a lot about the particular way you draw something. There's a kind of not just the technicalities of line weights or those kinds of things, but really there's a kind of expressiveness that comes through drawing to conjure a certain project into being. And I think that map making feels very similar to me. That yes, the way we draw the map really makes a difference, and we can conjure very different worlds if we're drawing it in this way versus some other way. And I think the other thing that is maybe less common, either from map makers or from people who use maps, is the idea that I see really maps as making worlds that might not yet exist. So maps not just as describing the world, But maps as really contributing to the world and really making the world anew, and making a new imagination of the world with every new map.
Wow, and that's the most radical aspect of cartography, surely.
That's the animating spirit of it. Yeah,
absolutely.
That maps are not just descriptions.
Yeah,
maps are imaginations. Maps are proposals. Maps are arguments about how the world is or how the world ought to be.
And I think the book does that very beautifully. I'm curious about what next for Radical Cartography. Where are you going next, Bill?
Oh, so I have, there's some projects that I'm following up on here and there, some collaborations with colleagues and things like that. To be honest, though, I don't know. I don't know if there's what more I have to say about maps at this point. I think that what was so wonderful about this project for me was that it was a way of getting my head around the last 15, 20 years of my own mapping. And now I think I have the luxury, the obligation to sit with it and to say, okay, what still feels right and what feels wrong? And that's going to take some time to think about.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that. You've just dropped a massive bomb into the middle of the history of cartography, and you can just walk away. I love that, Bill. Bill, that is absolutely wonderful. I think that that's a great way to end. Bill Rankin, thank you so much for joining me on What's Your Map to talk about Radical Cartography. What a great pleasure.
It was wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Bill's call to action to question maps and what they represent is really thought-provoking. I love that he makes us challenge the map and his advocacy of cartographers like Gwendolyn Warren. She was named an honorary geographer by the American Association of Geographers in 2025, a recognition that was long overdue. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland collection and send suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com.